bit by bit. So then you swap the various axes, x and y were, and the units, everything. And the error bars, more to the point. And I had arrived at this expression. There is a CL estimator, which is unbiased. And this thing, well, there's a cosmic variance. This isn't removable, it's always there. But then the thing which experimentalists can do to improve the situation is basically combine low noise with a very good beam, high resolution beam. Because what you get here on this other side is this thing which is the noise in each pixel times the pixel angular solid angle. And then we have a thing which is basically b minus 2. It's essentially the inverse of the beam. And this thing is L squared, sigma squared, and C squared. So people already asked, is this really realistic? No, this is not realistic. And this is not what people do to actually come up with these plots. But it's a work of something I can do on the blackboard. One of the problems is that the noise is not the same in every pixel. So the noise, as I said, is something which depends on the sensitivity of the detectors. And this thing, someone actually asked, where does the noise come from? Typical theorist question. And it comes from thermal noise, for example. So these things are actually cooled, pulled up very low temperature. You cannot put them at zero temperature. If you could, there will be quantum noise still. So this is the origin of the noise in everything. But then because you're integrating, the noise goes up and down, it's not systematic. As time goes on, integration time is bigger, you have less noise. And the problem is that you don't scan the sky uniformly. That's for those who ask the question. This is actually a picture of the time you spend on various things. All these plots are in galactic coordinates, which is why usually you find these galactic bundling here in the pictures I gave you before. The ecliptic, which is solar system, north pole and equator, is actually here and there. And if you put the satellite in L2, the thing is, well, it's essentially going around, scanning the sky, and ends up, because it's three big circles in the ecliptic plane, essentially end up scanning more in these directions than in these directions. That's what makes most of these calculations more difficult. So the noise model I gave is really a simple model, but anyway, it gives you an idea of the effect. It's always a combination of the beam, the resolution beam, and the actual noise. So I was going to apologize about all this very phenomenological experimental bit, but then people actually ask questions about it, so I'm going to apologize about it. And instead, what I will give you is a reference. And there are no books specifically about this. You ask me the question, can I read more about this? There's a website, though, which is called Lambda. It stands for Legacy Archive of some microwave, whatever, I don't care. Okay. Lambda, GSFC, NASA.gov. And this thing contains all kinds of papers, data, pretty pictures, all these various, so these pictures came from this site, actually. And if you want to learn more, there are no books about it, but anyway. You can find a lot of information there about how these observations are made. And they keep it updated, so every time there's a new release of that, it's there. There is a reference for the rest of these lectures, though, which is the theoretical side. The rest of the lectures are going to be more theoretical. And that's the Donaldson book. It's actually very good for this. Scott Donaldson, Modern Cosmology. I believe it's Academic Press. If you want to read more about the theory going here, it's quite a comprehensive and very up-to-date book. If you want to know more about the experiments, go to this website. Okay, how far have we gone? And I told you I would explain everything about these plots, how they're made. We know what this gray band is now. It's the cosmic variance. It's basically an error of the theory. The theory is not fully predicted. It doesn't predict our sky, but it's an ensemble of skies. You know why these things become bigger? Here is this noise effect combined with the beam. One thing that I didn't tell is the units. Why is it microkelvin square? Well, it's because temperature is in microkelvin. Therefore, DLMs are going to be in microkelvin times radian squared, if you want. Normally, radians are not taken into the unit. So, of course, the power spectrum is going to be microkelvin squared. Things on the order of 10 microkelvins, you get thousands. That's the reason why you get this kind of numbers here. And if you don't like the multipole moment, there's actually a rough angular scale correspondence up there. Bigger L means smaller angle. Okay? L goes like 1 over theta. So one thing I didn't explain in this plot is, what is this this red line, the theoretical prediction? And that's what we're going to be doing for the rest of these two lectures, maybe this lecture only, actually. And why do I put an L times L plus 1? All these things are going to be explained in this lecture, and there's a good reason for that. And we will be making connection, finally, with observations, with theory, sorry. So very roughly, let me explain where this stems from. So if you make a plot like this, there's going to be subtleties, which are going to be very important. But basically, if I write L times L plus 1 times CL against L, I will invariably predict something which starts off flat and then rises to a big peak, smaller peak, and it keeps going down. And there are three regimes here. This is the plateau, or the large angle plateau. This is the thing which COBE satellite first measured, and he measured because he had low resolution, so he couldn't go into the peaks. But then these things here are called the Doppler peaks. And they tail off into something which we call the silk damping pair. And roughly, very, very roughly, the transition here, what this thing means is the horizon staying at last scatter. So I explained there's these two phases in the life of the universe, transparent, opaque. Last scattering is the transition. It's not abrupt. That will be a problem, okay? But roughly, there's an horizon scale at last scattering. And this is where this transition goes between one of these and another of these regimes. So if you are outside these particular state, what you're getting is an imprint of the initial conditions, which is presumably the thing you've been computing in the lectures on inflationary models. So this is like pristine initial conditions as they arrive at last scattering, because we're still outside the horizon, haven't been touched. Things which have already been touched, because they've gone inside the horizon, into a series of oscillations, which are basically acoustic oscillations. Reason being that radiation has a very high pressure. Probably have seen this formula, which means there's a big restoration force if you go away from homogeneity, which means if you have a density wave, there's going to be a pressure wave, which is going to try and counteract the over-densities, and as a result, things oscillate. So these are actually sound waves in radiation. You probably have seen press releases with completely stupid things like the sound of the universe, or things like that. Or the face of God is the most stupid one I've heard, actually. But anyway, this is essentially what you're seeing there. These oscillations are acoustic oscillations in a radiation fluid. And the final thing which appears here, actually, which is an extra thing I will have time to discuss in the next lecture, is the gravity waves. On top of all, there's going to be possibly some gravity waves. Those will contribute mainly to this plateau, and we'll get there. Okay, so this is the rough physical picture, and kind of the crazy thing is that there will be a number of parameters we'd like to measure in cosmology, namely these ones, and they're really encoded in this line very, very precisely. I have some films prepared for you to show how these things change by changing the parameters, but I will give you some of the physics first and let you think about what the effect is with various parameters. But by measuring this curve very accurately, you're measuring two types of things. And It's not all fundamental physics. Really, when you go into the horizon, outside the horizon, you find this primordial pattern. But to my mind, there's two types of parameters which you can measure. One is something to do with primordial cosmology. And the other is day-to-day cosmology, if you want. Let me just say what kind of parameters will come into this curve. As I said, there's three levels in which you can look at the CMB, the mapped power spectrum, and if you have a theory, just these parameters. So by going through this calculation, my CL curve is going to be a function of various parameters. Some are really very fundamental, and we'll connect to the lectures on inflation. And things like this, delta square, of R, etc., are basically the thing that connects with inflation. This thing is essentially k cubed, the power spectrum of a quantity R I'm going to define as a function of k. What is the power spectrum? That's exactly the same thing I computed before with ALMs, but this time in Fourier modes. In this case, R is a function of k. R star is a function of k prime. Beforehand, there was a delta function that resulted from isotropy. Now there's a delta function that results from translational invariance. And then the quantity which multiplies it is the power spectrum. So this is a general definition of power spectrum if you have quantities which are defined on the plane instead of on the sphere. So what is this R? This R is called the curvature variable. Now let me tell you something about it. This is the thing which really comes out of a theory of the early universe. Where did these fluctuations come from? The very simple way to put it is the following. Suppose I have a series of observers which are moving along with the universe, basically free-falling observers in the universe. So you already have seen we have a dipole. We have a dipole because we're moving with respect to the cosmological frame. They have peculiar motions, and everyone has a peculiar motion. So if I go through these observers and I integrate them into lines of constant time, you can call this duly, the thing called Frobenius theorem that gives you the conditions for this to be done. But in general, I could imagine that these observers integrate into a series of surfaces, which will be orthogonal to them, equal time surfaces. Well, these things are going to basically be a bit weakly because not everyone is moving along with cosmological expansion, and people are moving in different ways. Some people are moving in one direction to the other. If you compute the curvature of this surface, this is what this thing is. Okay? The free curvature of this surface is essentially the curvature variable, which comes out as a way of qualifying the initial imprint and the fluctuation of the universe. Let me just give you a bit more about this, but if you want an exact formula, if you compute the Ricci free, and if you do this in Fourier space, then basically you get the k squared, a squared, and this curly R. This curly R is essentially, if you want, the potential for the Laplace working as like the main operator to give you this free curvature. So this is going to be very important. This is really the thing that is going to make the contact. You'll see how this appears in the observations, but it's the thing which is going to make contact with the inflationary model. And to give you another way to do this, I don't know, if you're a relativist, you love this, if you're a cosmologist, you probably want to see things in a different way. You take the Friedmann equation. So in general, so you have the expansion of the universe, the density, curvature term. Suppose you have a flat model. Suppose you have fluctuations. Well, basically, if you have an overdensity in a flat model, what you have is a small closed universe, because it's slightly overcritical. Whereas if you have an underdensity, you have a small saddle universe, a small open universe, because you're undercritical. You can write the Einstein, the Turbine-Einstein equations in a way that looks very much like the Friedmann equation, but in which your h squared now depends on x as well as on time. Well, if you do that, then you're going to get 8 pi g over 3, rho x and t, and then you get 2/3 Laplacian pure powers. So this is another way to define R. In a way, it's that if you live in a small closed universe because you're over dense, this is the local curvature.
And how can you define type constant in this case? I mean, it's A dot over A.
It's not, of course. What you do is, and I don't know if you've seen the Rachel-Dury equation or anything like that. So basically, every kind of flow can always be split into something that looks like an expansion curve. So it's that big that I'm computing. There's going to be vorticity in some cases, there's going to be shear, all kinds of things. There's always going to be a term in every flow that looks like expansion. So that's what I've written there. So I'm just being a bit loose about this, but there's a way.
This time is still FRW, this time, or of course it's not?
No, it's perturbed FRW, exactly.
It is perturbed over FRW. Yeah.
So this is if you have a fluctuation around FRW, which is flat, actually.
So these are not exact equations, are perturbations?
No, I can write the perturbation, yeah, the first one, the linear acts. Okay?
Yes.
But in addition, what this is basically, I go to the Einstein equations,
yes.
And I go to the thing which I identify as H. In every flow, I can do that.
Uh-huh.
And I can read off something that formally looks like this from those equations, and then I identify the R from that expression. And physically, I know that, of course, it's going to coincide with the R because of, what is it called? The Birkhoff's theorem. You could use Birkhoff's theory, for example. If you have a spherical symmetric situation, at least you can use Birkhoff's theory. But it's more general, actually. So you don't need to have spherical symmetry. But actually, these are defined as well. So I'm just making sure, I don't know exactly what variable you've been using in lectures on inflation. I'm just making sure that, you know, because this is really what appears in these tables, is these are variables. I'm just making sure you have something to do. So for example, I don't know. Well, you tell me, what variable have you been using for defining primordial power spectrum inflation? Potential, curvature? I haven't come into the lecture. So. Obviously, you have not been paying attention, I can see.
Next, I have one question here. For the Bronner spectrum, it seems the transition invariant because it's a function delta of k minus k prime.
Yeah.
That's right. But here you are thinking that it depends on the position.
No, that's the average. So that's an average over an ensemble of universes. Obviously, any concrete realization of the universe violates translational invariance. We violate translational invariance. It's the ensemble that on average doesn't have a preferred position. So this is called statistical translational invariance. Whenever I put correlators, they cannot depend on where I start.
So this is not just quantum chemical averages?
No, this is what I mentioned in the last lecture, an average over an ensemble of universes. Or an average over volumes, horizon volumes, disconnected horizon volumes. That's what I mean. Okay, just to make sure I'm completely covered against being sued or something. Sometimes you use this variable, which is expansion. And then, so sometimes this variable is not the same as this one. If we have no viscosity, this is the same. So I don't know how you could do in computations in inflation, but basically this R is proportional to phi. At least if the equation of state, that is includes inflation, this includes after inflation, the equation of state is between -5/3 and 1. So unless I have a crazy kind of model with functions, even that extreme phantom matter, etc., I can interchangeably modify these primordial fluctuations with the Newtonian potential, which is what people sometimes use, and this curvature variable. This curvature variable is normally a more resilient way of modifying them, but in general, and this is not a, at least if I have this condition, it's not an easy proof. I can show this is proportional. Okay, so this is one of the important variables which are going to come out of here. What people actually compute, let me show you, is essentially So this delta, which appears there, is actually k cubed. And then the power spectrum in R, or in phi, actually doesn't matter in this case. This thing is dimensionless. If you actually compute the unit your Fourier transform of phi and then in the power spectrum, when you put the k cubed there, which has units of inverse length, this thing does not have units. So if I want something which is scaling invariant, this should be just a constant, a dimensionless constant. If I want a dependence on k, I have to have a preferred k, because I have to write k over k0, or k preferred, times ns. And ns is called spectral index. And ns equals 1 is scaling invariant, because then I don't need, on dimensional grounds, to include a preferred state. But for some reason, people look at 200 megaparsecs, or rather 0.002 megaparsecs, minus 1, as the pivot state. Don't worry about that. If you have any kind of running of the spectral index, or the spectral index which is not run, I need to refer it to preferred scale. Otherwise, I have scaling variance. It's much easier model. So this is what really is going to appear in all these calculations. It's going to be all kinds of parameters. There's going to be the amplitude. There's going to be the spectral index. There's even going to be something which is the running of the spectral index. That's predicted in some models of inflation. And then there's going to be the amount of gravitational waves. There's going to be the tilting gravitational wave spectrum, etc., etc. So I could include here things like R, the ratio of scalars to tensors, or NP, the spectral index for the tensor. And this is the kind of thing which I can detect most directly here. But of course, it's going to have an input, an off-on input on everything else, including the Doppler.
I'm confused between two points. The Bohr spectrum of the inflaton itself and this power spectrum, do you
find it? Why is it computing the power spectrum of the inflaton, is it? So you should at some point relate that to this curvature variable, because it's proportional to variable. So that's the reason. I'll never work with it. Because otherwise you're really talking across purposes. Okay. So the reason why I choose this variable R is that we can prove that it's, unless we have viscosity or kinds of general conditions. In general, R is conserved, doesn't change in time. You push the node outside the horizon and this thing doesn't change, so it's constant. Which is not true in the potential, by the way. So even if you change the equation of state, this guy stays exactly the same until nowadays. So you create the modes, the fluctuations, you push them outside the horizon, they will be proportional to your inflaton field. But then as inflation finishes, there's going to be reheating, the thing is going to go into radiation epoch, into matter epoch, and these guys conserve, that's why we use it. It doesn't change. The potential depends on the equation of state, and every time the equation of state goes from minus 1 to a third to 0, it changes. So this R is really the thing which pegs down in a conserved manner of what really was left there initially, which is the reason why you use it. And it is proportional to inflaton. Of course, nowadays there's no inflaton anymore, and there's still fluctuations. Okay, is this clear? I'll talk to your lecturer anyway, when he's made there as well. It's actually non-trivial because the relation, I didn't actually write the factor in there, but that factor is actually a number which contains minus W minus 1. So in principle, the potential is actually 0 during inflation, for example. So it's a lot more complicated than what it might look like just from looking at the inflaton field. So the expression is actually, there's a number here, which is 5 plus 3W, 3 times 1 plus W. And when W is minus 1 exactly, actually this thing blows up, right? So the phi is 0. So strictly speaking, there's no phi if I have exact the C3 inflation, which I never have anyway. Okay? Okay, so this is the thing which connects with your lectures on inflation. A lot of other things have to do with cosmology, and essentially what I call day-to-day cosmology means the world we live in. And let me just mention what these various things are. So day-to-day cosmology, and you're going to have things like the value of omega. So from this expression, for a given expansion rate, I know what is the critical density. I just set the k to 0, that gives me a value for critical density. So omega equals rho over rho critical is a thing which is 1 for a flat universe. It's bigger than 1 for a closed universe, and smaller than 1 for an open universe. So this whole picture, we have in Friedman models, three different options for the curvature that's defined by omega. It's going to have a very big imprint on what happens here, these peaks, where they are, location of these peaks. I will be showing you a few later on how these things change with omega. Very dramatic. And then I have things like how much of this omega is made up of baryonic matter, how much of it is made up of cosmological function, how much of it is just cold dark matter, for example. What is the Hubble parameter? This is very important. What is the age of the universe? How fast we're expanding? It's going to have an imprint as well into the microwave background. People thought it might be easy just to look at the expansion and infer it, but actually this is a very nice way to measure it. And surprisingly, things like the reionization, well, unsurprisingly, things like the reionization, Z reionization, which I mentioned in the last lecture, said, well, that is linked with here, there, has to do with the astrophysical life of the universe. Surprisingly, as I was saying, things like the mass of the neutrino. You actually get already very important, valuable constraints of the mass of the neutrino using the microwave background. So there's going to be particle physics coming in as well. Okay? So some of it is primordial cosmology, some of it is the world we live in now, important parameters. What is our age, how far down the line we are, what is the composition of the universe. But there is some particle physics input here as well. And you can learn quite a lot, and depending on what your interest here is, I'll be giving you a mixture. I won't talk about neutrinos very much, but I'll give you a mixture of stuff which connects with your lectures on inflation and just general late time cosmology. Okay, so I'm going to be doing a calculation. I've been threatening this for a while, and now it's the time to do it. And I won't be doing the full calculation, because it's quite really nasty, and I need a computer anyway. But I will be doing an approximate calculation, and I'll tell you what the exact calculation is, and because we need it for the next lecture. Okay. Any questions about this? I'll be moving on now to actually computers. I'll be fleshing up this picture. Keep this picture in mind. What I'll be doing is essentially fleshing all these out. Okay, how do you compute this thing? Unfortunately, the next lecture I'll have to give you the real calculation. And the real calculation is solving the Boltzmann equation. As you know, it's not an easy thing to solve. But what the Boltzmann equation gives you is, if you have anything which is going through a phase which may be not a fluid phase and not free streaming, you need a full Boltzmann equation. So what happens in the universe is that there's going to be a time, which I call the last scattering time, after which there's almost no collisions between the photons and the rest of the stuff in the universe, and before which there's lots of collisions. So what I'll be doing in this lecture is basically break the calculation into two regimes and then glue them together. This one here, I'm going to use the fluid approximation. I'm going to treat the microwave background radiation as a fluid. And this is called tight coupling approximation. And then, well, then you have last scattering, and then I'm going to be treating these as free streaming. And this is easy to do, right? Well, reasonably easy to do. The problem is that this transition is not abrupt. Free streaming. The problem is there's always going to be a time here in between one and the other in which things and not yet free spinning, but they start decoupling, so basically not a perfect fluid either. You get viscosity, you get diffusion, you get all kinds of effects. So there's a funny phase here in between in which there is diffusion. This is actually the thing which explains the sealed damping tail. So I won't be able to explain the damping tail in this lecture with the calculation I'm going to do because I'm throwing away this regime. So there's going to be viscosity, and essentially there's going to be a term which produces polarization here. So I would not be able to do a calculation for polarization in this approximation either. Polarization occurs in this phase in which things are still scattering, the photons are still scattering off the electrons, but things are no longer a perfect fluid. So this is a difficult thing to compute, and unfortunately, well, I don't care so much about sealed damping, but actually polarization is very important, and I won't be able to compute that in the approximation in this lecture. So the way you do this, actually, as you know, there's a distribution function, and you just have a Boltzmann equation for this distribution function. I'll tell you a bit about it next time. But let me just say, if you have something which is formalized anyway, you end up expanding this x into Fourier modes, and then you have an x dot p, and you expand this guy into the Schoenherr polynomial. So you end up with something which is a theta of L of k and t. And what you find is that if I have tight coupling, then the theta zero is roughly, or it's proportional, to the delta rho, or the delta t. The theta one is proportional to the velocity in the photons. And that's it. This is the end of the story. So this enormous hierarchy of equations which represent the Boltzmann equation just gets truncated into two equations, which are essentially continuity equation and the Euler equation. But the terms I've been describing here is actually the theta 2, which is a viscosity term. The theta 2 is the term which produces polarization, and I'll give you some physical reasons for it later on. So I'm truncating the Boltzmann equation. That's really what I'm doing when I'm talking about this division between collisionless and totally collision-dominated fluid. But I'm throwing away very important terms which arise in the transition between one regime and the other, and which do lead to polarization. Okay, so let me do the calculation. What I'm going to be doing now is doing the free spinning calculation, first of all. Then I'll be doing the fluid calculation, and I'm going to glue everything together. And gradually, the plot for the CLs is going to appear. So a very kind of approximate plot, which doesn't have the sealed damping, for example, but explains why there's an L times L plus 1. It connects that with the spectral index, which appears in the scalar invariance definition, etc. Okay, so let me do the free streaming first. So in this case, what I do is I go back to this picture I gave in the first lecture. We're inside a cavity, looking out into the sky, and we see this last scattering surface with the photons coming directly to us from a phase in which the universe was opaque. So this is the cavity, which we call the sky. We're here. This is the observer. And let's look at the given photon, which leaves the last scattering surface. So this thing was emitted at the eta last scattering. We're observing at eta zero. But it's far away as well. Remember, the sky is a cone in four dimensions, as I said. And let's follow the life of this photon. So it's a photon which leaves at the time initial and arrives at the time final. So let n be the direction in the sky I'm looking. So n is the unit vector in the direction I'm looking. And what I'll be doing is essentially follow photons with different energies. So I'm going to be looking at photons with different energies. There's an unperturbed energy is zero. What I really want to know is what does this become? What energy, what fluctuation in energy does this translate? Because of various inhomogeneities in the universe. The fact that I don't live in an exactly homogeneous and isotropic universe. So one thing which is important is that if I have delta E over E, and this does not depend on the energy, then the perturbed spectrum is also thermal. And this happens invariably if I have fluctuations which arise from gravity, for example. And anyway, all the other things I will mention here in this talk. I look at photons in a Planck spectrum. They all have a different energy, a perturbed energy, but the delta E over E does not depend on the energy. So what this means is that the new spectrum is thermal. And this constant is actually delta T over T. Exercise. Very easy to prove. Let's just take the Planck formula, then linearly perturb the delta E and every photon, so that you obtain another Planck formula with a delta T over T, which is proportional to this delta T over T. So what I need to do is compute this delta E for a given photon. And I know what the delta T over T is, because I know this is the same for all of them, all the ensemble of photons. I start with. Okay. First thing I need to know the perturbation in the metric. So very generally, I write this perturbation as ds squared equals a squared 1 plus, I'll pick this general. So I said in here that in general, this guy here I put in there does not need to be equal to this one. So that actually depends on viscosity. Viscosity is not zero, then those two potentials are different. And this is not going to be the case here, but if you look at the Einstein equations, that's one of the things you learn. So let me keep this general in this calculation here. And basically, I should have a fluctuation in the time-time and a fluctuation in the space-space. And then I have something which is the gravitational wave. I'll explain a bit more about why the metric in general can be written in this form, but this is basically the first thing I need. It's a fluctuation in the metric. So how many of you have actually had a course in cosmological perturbation theory? Okay, so you can recognize it, but no one else probably can recognize it. And let me just say a few words. Obviously, I would need a full week, as you probably know, to describe cosmological perturbation theory. It's a very, very complex field. But basically, there are a few problems, not just technical problems, but conceptual problems, when you perturb a Friedman universe. And in fact, you write the Einstein equations linearized in such a perturbed universe. Let me just mention a few things about it on the side here. So the first thing you need to know is, for example, when you write the metric as an A square, Minkowski, and then an H mu. First thing you need to know is that, generally, if you look at this matrix, you can divide these components as scalars, vectors, and tensors with respect to the three geometry. So the time-time guy in here is obviously a scalar, because it doesn't have any special indices. The not I guy here is going to be some vi, which can be written as the gradient of a v scalar and the current free field. And you can do a similar thing with space-space b. So if you have an hij, you can write these as, well, there's different ways to do it, but one of them is ei dj minus 1/3 delta ij delta squared H scalar. Then you can write a vector B, which is very similar to this one. You take a vector field, which is solenoidal, divergence free, and you can write it like this. And then finally, you take a bit, which is the remainder, and this is called the TT, transverse traceless component, and this thing has the property that it does not have a divergence. So it's the equivalent of a solenoidal field, but for a matrix, and it's traceless. And generally speaking, you can do this with anything you do in when you split into 3 plus 1 when you do the perturbation calculation. So this could be a stress energy tensor, it could be a metric, it could be anything. So invariably what you find is a composition into scalars, vectors, and tensors. The scalars represent density fluctuations. The vectors represent vorticity fluctuations, and the tensors represent gravity waves. We won't need anything. We'll need the vorticity in these particular models anyway, is what you're looking at. In general, there is a vorticity term. You'll be looking at the scalars and at the tensors. And what happens is that there is a thing called gauge freedom. So your choice of units or your choice of coordinates can always be changed. And these variables invariably change because you just apply a coordinate transformation to them. So what you call the perturbation really is coordinate dependent until you fix the gauge. And you can use your gauge freedom to actually place the metric into this form, in which all I've done is I've actually thrown away, for the scalars, the zero y component. So in general here, there's going to be my zero y components in the perturbations will have a bit which is the gradient of the scalar. This can be set to zero using the gauge freedom. And the vector bit I threw away by definition, because I say it's not, doesn't matter in my case. And the TT is already gauge invariant. So this is actually the most general form of the metric. If I have a scalar and a tensor fluctuation, if I choose what is called the longitudinal gauge, or the Newtonian gauge. Okay? And as I said, to do this properly, I probably need like a full week of lectures to actually explain how these various Einstein equations are put together, how to make them gauge invariant, how they look in different gauges, etc. Any questions about this? If you've never seen this before, it's going to be a bit too fast, or maybe we need to address it properly. Okay, the rest is actually easy. So the first thing you need is the metric. The second thing you need the k nu of the photon, the forward vector of the photon, and you need the u nu of the observer, because the observed energy, which is the thing I want to compute, my delta T over T, is actually minus K dot U. So there's a dot in there which is actually the metric, and the metric is perturbed, which is why I need to write it in this form. Okay, let's follow on to this. So I could leave this as an exercise for the student, but it would be very easy for me, but not for you, I'm sure. So let me just give you the calculation. Let me write the u. The u in general can be written in this form. So this is u, b, b as in baryon, made of baryon, so if you have any kinds of things, you put u, b there. And the zero component of this guy is 1 minus psi. It's going to be a spatial component which describes the peculiar velocity. That's dB. And this thing contains 1 over a. Reason is u dot u must be minus 1. Okay? So one thing which is perhaps not obvious is that you need to put the perturbation there, because otherwise u squared is not minus 1. G not not has a 2 psi there. If the u not didn't have the psi, u squared will not be minus 1, will not be normalized. In other words, it would mean that this u not be defined with respect to the proper time of the observer. Okay, this is another thing we need. The other thing is k nu, the four vector of the photon. This thing is E0, the unperturbed energy. What we want is perturbed energy. E0 divided by A. And now let me write here z mu plus delta n mu, in which n mu equals 1 minus n. So if I'm looking in the direction n, I'm observing photons going in the direction minus n. Get the sign right, otherwise the Doppler effect is going to come wrong. So there's a perturbation here, which I just parameterized by pulling out the E0 over A. If you want, as an exercise, just check that if I have no fluctuations, minus K dot U is E0. So we take the metric without the fluctuations, the k and the u without fluctuations, complete minus k dot u, that gives you the right normalization. So what I need to do is compute the energy, finally, the energy as I observe it. And this thing is minus k dot u, finally. So just plug everything in. It's a linearized calculation, so you throw away anything which is second or higher order. Just keep the first order terms. And what you get is E0, 1 plus psi. This is a bit surprising, because it gives you the wrong result for the gravitational redshift, but we'll sort out the sign. This is actually not a mistake, this is a plus. You get 1 plus psi plus delta N0 plus N dot E. Okay, so this is expression 1. You recognize the Doppler effect in there, our killer Doppler effect. We have a delta M0 here. So how do I find the delta M0? So the delta M0 is the second thing you need to compute. You simply write delta M0, final minus initial. So this notation means delta M0 final minus delta M0 initial. And the way this is done is I explicitly use integration by parts and write this thing as d lambda d delta zero by d lambda. Integral between the initial point, the last happening point, and the observation. And now I must use the geodesic equation to integrate. So what I do next is essentially I plug in the geodesic equation into this expression, and I can write that integral as something which contains those fluctuations in the metric. Okay. So exercise for you, if you want to fill in the details. What you must do now is essentially compute the first order perturbation, not the zero order, that's obvious, but the first order perturbation in this equation. If you go through that, you get an expression using that definition for KU, you get an expression for this quantity. And you finally get that delta N0, final minus initial, equals, and be careful, there's going to be three terms there. Every time you have a connection, you get three terms, but two of them are actually complete derivatives, so fortunately, what you end up is minus the psi, final minus initial, and you get a term which is d lambda, nu, nu, h nu. So two of the terms which appear in the connection are actually, or can be written as d by d lambda, and you need to break it out, and the other one cannot stay like that. So what I can do now is plug in the delta N0 final in terms of this expression. The problem is, what is the delta N0 initial? So that's the third bit of the calculation. Fortunately, what I can do is repeat calculation number one, but at time initial, and obtain exactly the same thing, but computed at the time initial, at last happening time. I obtain E initial equals E0, initial, obviously, 1 plus psi plus delta N0. Was m dot v initial. So it's the same calculation, but I compute it, instead of computing it here, with me observing the sky, I compute it there, with the barium that last scattered the photon. Okay, so the vb there refers to a barium which last scattered the photon at this point. So I can already eliminate this guy, delta n initial, in that expression there. Problem is, what is this guy here? Okay, and what this thing means is intrinsically the fluctuation in the density or in the temperature of the microwave background at last scattering. So the same way that I have a delta E over E at the end, which is a delta T over T, I will have an intrinsic fluctuation in the microwave background initially. Okay? And I can read it off simply by using EI minus E0, I divided by E0. And the way this is traditionally discussed is not in terms of the temperature, because I'm not sitting here with the W map observing the photon, but it's discussed in terms of the density fluctuation at last scattering. So if I have a temperature fluctuation at last scattering, I can use the Boltzmann, Stefan Boltzmann equation, rho is proportional to t to the fourth, do a Taylor expansion, and you find that delta t over t equals 1/4 of delta rho over rho. And this delta rho over rho is essentially the density contrast in the radiation at last time. So this is it. I mean, it was a long calculation, but now it's essentially plugging this expression into 1 to eliminate delta n0 final. You still have a delta n0 initial. And then use this expression for eliminating the delta n0 initial in terms of the psi initial, the VD initial, and the density contrast initial. So replace everything, and I'm going to give you the final formula. It's called the Sachs-Wolf formula. Describes everything in terms of the free streaming period. And the result is, so the psi actually is going to appear with the right sign because it appears here, it minus psi is useful. What you get in the end is delta E over E or delta T over T final equals N dot V final plus psi plus 1/4 delta gamma minus N dot V D initial. And then you get the term, which is minus 1/2 intra between initial and the end of d lambda phi dot plus psi dot. And then you get the bit which represents the gravity waves as well. And this is a very important formula. It describes the whole free spinning, really, generational fluctuation. I threw away a psi initial here, by the way, because this does not depend on the direction. So if I'm on the top of a potential hill, everything has to climb the potential hill the same way. And it doesn't really cause any anisotropy, it just shifts the zero order temperature. So I threw that away. But what is this? OK, let's examine physically what each of these terms means now. So this thing here is the famous Doppler term. I showed you a picture earlier on. If you make a picture of the microwave background, the first thing you see is just homogeneous, and really Kelvin level you see a dipole. What this dipole is basically a measure of your of our movement with respect to the cosmological threshold. And this was first measured by a spy plane. It was a very strange thing to do, but there was actually a plane going all the way from North Canada to the tip of South America. They managed to convince all the governments in between, you're looking at the sky and not down. And it was the first time you actually measured using actually the same technology which was then later put on the COBE satellite. This thing was actually measured. And the result is very surprising. The dipole is in the opposite direction. We appear to be moving with respect to our local neighborhood, which means that the big bit, the big coherent movement in which we seem to be riding on is actually moving in the opposite direction at much faster speed than what we thought. So this thing has a lot of physics, but it's basically sun puzzling physics. But it's nothing to do with fundamental physics, I hope, anyway. So what is this? These terms here represent basically fluctuations in the last scattering surface. So this is things which are going to be a legacy of the phase in the universe before it became transparent. And specifically, if in the last scattering surface I'm on the top of a hill, then, well, then I come down and I have a blue shift, so I end up with things heated up as I observe them now. So I'm looking at the last scattering surface. Every time I have the top of a hill, I will see things that will be blue shifted by the gravitational redshift. So this is the gravitational redshift effect. This thing is called intrinsic fluctuation, which means if I look in one given direction and the microwave background was hotter there, of course I'll see things hotter now. Okay? And in addition, there is a Doppler effect if the baryons, which last scattered the photons, are moving in my direction. Okay. So the end point in this direction is the V point in the opposite direction, hence the minus sign. I have a blue shift because of a Doppler shift. But not the Doppler shift because of my movement, but because of the movement of the last scattered. So these three effects are really quite easy to understand. This guy here, I don't know if you've seen anything like this before, like in school or something, normally not. This thing is called the integrated size book.
Sure.
Integrated size book. And this is what happens every time you have a field which is not conservative. So if you have a potential which is changing in time, you invariably find that you may be going down one potential and coming up another. And as a result, there's going to be an effective blue shift which contains an integral over the path. And it's not just a difference initial and final. You probably have heard about this, if not in school, you probably have heard about this with the NASA and NASA website, the thing called the slingshot effect, which is when you throw a satellite, for example, behind Jupiter. And think accelerate is exactly an example of integration science. So the slingshot effect is what happens if the potential for which you're moving is actually changing in time in the reference frame you're looking at. So if you send the satellite in front, you actually break. You reduce speed, you send it behind, you accelerate. And in a way, that's exactly what this is doing. Here, very important, the gravity waves are going to be an integrated science. Any questions about this? It's essentially the physics.
Yeah. Yes. What basically we're talking about the energy of the physical photon, right?
Yeah.
Changes.
Yeah. You disagree with it?
No, I don't.
So right at the start, I said this is an ensemble of photons which are thermal, right? They have a Planck form. And what I need to know is what is the fluctuation in the energy of each of these photons. And what I said is that if delta E over E is proportional to some, is basically a number which doesn't depend on the E, I started from, then thermal remains thermal. And is delta E over E is the fluctuation in the temperature. There is an assumption here, which is that the initial fluctuation kept things thermal. Okay? This is an assumption. I didn't prove this. Everything else, namely what happens here, okay? So things which happen in between last scattering and nowadays do not disturb the thermal spectrum fluctuations. Neither does the Doppler effect. This is an assumption. I'm assuming that things initially were thermalized. If they were not thermalized, it's a different story. Any more questions? So I'm afraid we have to suffer a bit before I show you the film. It will come in the end. I promise to do a calculation, so I'm doing it. There are a couple of subtleties, actually. So whenever people write expressions like this one, there is a gauge issue in terms of how I define this. So sometimes, and this is to do with the initial condition, sometimes you actually combine this delta with the potential, create gauge invariant variables in different ways. In fact, invariably, the way people do this, the psi and the delta, as you write them, have opposite signs. So the thing I said, whenever I look at the hot spot in the sky, I'm looking at the hotter gray background. What happens is that actually the thing was blue shifted much more by the potential. So this guy is actually twice this guy for most initial conditions. Whenever I see a hot spot in the sky, what I see is something which was initially a cold spot, but it was actually blue shifted very strongly. Okay? If you buy George Smoot's idea that you see the face of God, you see the negative face of God, because it's actually the other way around, things are turned around. But this is a gauge statement, and this is just a subtlety in case you've seen this before. Okay? Right, so what I'm going to be doing now is basically put everything together and explain where the plateau comes from, where the fluctuations, the acoustic oscillations come from, etc. So let me explain this now. Let me start with this thing, the plateau. Where does the plateau come from? If I actually separate these various terms. The plateau is actually this guy here. It's a gravitational tension. And this case, actually, they use the gauge in which the acoustic oscillations inside the horizon get combined with the potential. I explained just the separately just now. And basically, you get the Sachs-Wolf, which propagates into the plateau as well. In general, people don't do that, so this guy falls off for low L, and the only thing you need to worry about is this. So don't worry about this gauge issue. Ignore it for the time being. I'm going to tell you a bit about it. I'll explain now why is it that if I have scaling variance in initial conditions, I end up with a power spectrum which is flat with an L times L plus 1 multiplying the CL. If you didn't like my last calculation, this one is going to be beautiful. It's going to be Bessel functions galore. So get ready for it. Now let me do the calculation, at least you know what this means. So I'm going to be separating the various terms which appear. First one is going to be the potential. I'm going to be computing the CL that came from just the potential term in that expression. And he's going to explain the large angle or the low L platform. So as I said, this thing is actually a direct measurement of the pristine initial conditions because you're looking outside the horizon as it was at last scattering. And this is something I have to give you as a given. It's an equal. So basically, when I break these various terms, what you get for low L is just this guy and everything else disappears. So this guy dies at L equals 1, of course. You don't have to worry about this guy. But these various things are going to be dominant only at much higher L. And I'll be looking at this one first. So what I have is delta T over T in a given direction n. It's going to be proportional. And I put the proportional here because already there might be factors of minus 2 or 3. Depending on how I write the delta. But anyway, it doesn't matter. I won't care much about the amplitude. This thing is going to be proportional to phi in the direction. So what I have is, again, from here, this is direction n. What I'm observing is the potential E at last scattering surface, the time of last scattering surface, but also very far away. And if I use the moving coordinates, this x, should be n times eta 0 minus eta last scattering. So I must put things into the distance, because there's going to be, of course, they're going to be far away from here and into the past. And this guy here is usually written delta eta last scattering. And you can compute it as an exercise for you. Okay? So using the fact that it's basically redshift of 1,000, you can find what is the difference in conformal time between last scattering and other days. So what I need to do, my input here is going to be the power spectrum, right? It's going to be the thing which I defined earlier on as the Fourier space ensemble average of this guy, which is a delta in k and k prime times the power spectrum. And I'm using the potential here because actually I can use interchangeably the potential and the curvature variable if I have a matter epoch or radiation epoch in the universe. Because this thing is defining Fourier space, what I have to do now is look at the anisotropy that's produced wave by wave. So if I map a wave into the sky, I'm going to have a correspondence between k and L, which is going to be slightly broad. And it's going to be slightly broad because you always find that near the poles here, there's going to be some distortion. Near the equator, it's quite more or less obvious that a given wavelength corresponds to a given angular scale. But near the polar caps, things are going to be a bit broader. So this correspondence between k and l is something which is going to lead these Bessel functions, these various things, they're called projectors. And the projector is not a very spiky thing. So there's leakage between k and l. When you go from one to the other, you lose information. So if the power spectrum wasn't just a power law, as I wrote it, then you said Coca-Cola, something crazy like that. What you'd see in the CLs would be a very blurred version of Coca-Cola because of this. There will be like a leakage between some case and some else, and you'll be losing information. Okay, so what I do here is I write the phi as V3k phi of k e to the ikx. So I should be putting proportionals here, pi cubed and 2 pi cubed L. I'm going to throw that away. That's 1, okay? I'm ignoring all that. So what I get is delta t over t in direction n as the result of all these different waves in different directions contributing to the delta t over t in n. So this is going to be proportional to d3k phi of k e to last scattering. Remember, the Fourier components in general depend on time as well. If these guys contribute the e to last scattering, this must as well. And then I get e to the I k, and what is x? Well, x now is n times delta e to last scattering. Okay, so it doesn't stop. Be careful with that guy in there. So what I want is not delta t over t as a function of n. What I want is the spherical harmonics. If you've done any kind of quantum mechanical scattering, you've seen a formula which essentially splits plane waves into spherical harmonics. I don't know if you've seen this, but if you have a Coulomb scattering problem in quantum mechanics, at some stage, you have a formula which gives you a plane wave. Written as 4 pi, sum over L, and N, I to the L, as your beloved Bessel function, which I've been telling you is going to appear, K, R, and then you have YLN in the direction K, and YLN in the direction X. So using this expression, what I can do is plug these in the expression above there, and then rig off the LNs. Okay? If I do that, there will be one thing which is a YLN as a function of N. The factor which is in front is the ALX, the coefficient of the spherical harmonic expansion. So I won't be doing that explicitly, but just read it off, plug this in there, and read off ALN as the term, as the factor which multiplies YLN of the direction. So what this thing is D3K, or proportional to D3K, I to the L, Bessel function, K delta eta last scattering, YLM, K, and the potential is K eta last scattering. Okay? So there's just straightforward substitution and then reading off the ALM coefficient. Well, this is almost there. What I need now is actually the correlator. So I have ALN, AL prime, M prime star, and symbol average. So what I need is plug this expression. It's going to be huge, but it's going to be quite straightforward. So this is going to be a double integral in K. Okay? Then I have two Bessel functions. One per factor. Well, there's an I here, but don't worry about it, it's not very important. I to the L plus L prime. And multiplying these, I'm going to have the potential, so phi of k at last scattering, and phi of k prime at last scattering. This is the only thing which is a stochastic variable. So if I'm computing an ensemble average, this will have to transfer into this expression here, this factor there. And then finally, I have the YLN star direction K, YL prime, M prime of direction K prime. So this is, if you've done any quantum field theory, this is a typical thing. But once we get here, the fortunate thing is that this is actually a delta function in K and K prime times the power spectrum.
I've been doing this.
It's going to disappear.
I believe in that.
And the fact that I have a delta function here, I'm going to write C1. So this is going to be just a single integral. This collapses because of this delta function. And then I'm going to introduce polar coordinates. So it's going to be a k-square here. It's going to be the power spectrum in phi of k, eta mass scattering. I forgot to put it there, but it should be there. And then I have JL k delta eta mass scattering, JL prime k delta eta mass scattering. And then I have the rest of the integral. So I'm using polar coordinates. There should be angular coordinates corresponding to k, the direction of k. And this thing contains the spherical harmonics. And it's exactly this thing, using the fact that the spherical harmonics are orthonormal, that gives me the delta n, or the delta L prime, delta n, n prime. The thing which multiplies this is going to be the CL, the power spectrum. Yeah, I'm tired as well. So finally, so this correlator is going to be those deltas times CL. By reading off the CL, you get proportional to dk squared, p of phi of k. And this is the thing I call the projector. It's going to be the square of the Bessel function. Okay? Okay? So if I have a power low, it's straightforward to do this integral. If I have a more complicated spectrum with features, I'm going to be erasing those features in some sense. And then, so finally, just simply is something you can actually read off. From a grad student reasoning, something which has integrals on Bessel functions. If you have a scaling variant spectrum, if this thing k cubed times the power spectrum does not depend on k, this thing doesn't have any dimensions, therefore, if I don't want to have a scale, there cannot be a k dependence there, then the CLs become proportional to dk over k, JL square k delta eta last scattering. And go and look at this integral, basically what you find in the end is this goes like 1 over L times L. So we have to sweat to get this result. And this is just the first term, the whole CL. But anyway, this is the reason why you get L times L plus 1 in these plots. If I have scaling variance in the initial conditions, this propagates into a CL spectrum that goes like 1 times L plus 1. So if you want scaling variance in three dimensions, translates into scaling variance in two dimensions. If I have two dimensions, it will be k squared times the power spectrum. If I am, L is a bit like k, and k squared is a bit like L times L plus 1. Okay? So the reason is, essentially, scaling variance just projects into the sky if it is out there in three dimensions. But if you want the rigorous calculation, this is what you need. You need to know some Bessel functions, and some integrals of Bessel functions. You need to know that expression I wrote about how to expand the plane wave into spherical harmonics. Okay, we're nearly there. This was a bit slower than anticipated. What I think I'm going to do is just show you the film as motivation for the next lecture and pack you off to lunch a bit earlier. What I'll be doing the next lecture is actually explain where these fluctuations come from. So the only thing we've done so far is actually this bit here, the plateau. I'll be explaining why is it, if you look into the tight coupling regime, you get these acoustic oscillations, they come from there, and then you simply project into the delta, into the CLs, the same way I did. The thing which is, just to make contact with what I did earlier on, the thing which is amazing here is that actually all these various parameters, which I showed you earlier on, will have a very strong input, a very strong imprint upon these curves. All this calculation, incidentally, was done in a flat space-time, otherwise I wouldn't be able to use, for example, Fourier transforms like that. It'll be more complicated Fourier transforms on a sphere or an hypersphere. So the projector will be different in that case. So what do you find in that, if you actually have any kind of curvature? You find that this vector changed completely. So just look at the top guy to begin with. But the place where these, the top, where this first peak appears, depends crucially on whether the universe is flat, open or closed. I'll explain you a bit why in the next lecture. This is how my next lecture is going to start. I'm going to pick up from here, maybe fill in some details, but essentially explain why this happens. It's a complication upon this calculation. What you're doing is looking at the last scattering surface, and essentially looking at the span of the horizon of the last scattering surface and projecting these into angles. If the universe is closed, the geodesics are geodesics on a sphere, and they will be projecting to a much larger angle, which means lower L, which means all those peaks are going to be to the left. If I have an hypersphere, it's the opposite. The geodesics would be like these. So the same physical distance would become a much smaller angle, which means a much higher L, and you'd be projecting into a much higher L all these peaks. So this is essentially a transition between the calculation I did today and the acoustic oscillations I've been announcing, but which I didn't compute yet. Things like, for example, I'll give you just one more, a couple more maybe. The cosmological constant does a very similar thing, just because it changes the mapping between distance and redshift. So this distance is going to be different, depending on how much cosmological constant there is. And in fact, there is a degeneracy between how much cosmological constant there is and the geometry of the universe. I can kind of find combinations of parameters which would actually leave the microwave background and change, and I will never be able to leave that degeneracy using the microwave background. I would, however, if I use a polarization, of course. One thing which is quite surprising is I can actually measure much of the stuff in the universe is baryonic. So things like, I don't know, modified Newtonian gravity theories and things like that, which don't have dark matter. There's a lot of trouble explaining these, but essentially, the relative heights of the peaks, which are odd and even, changes. And I'll explain why this happens in the next lecture. So it's some subtlety to do with this guy here, and also this guy there. So all this thing about trying to measure the third peak is not because I want a better picture. The third peak really takes down much dark matter than has been in the universe, how much baryonic matter there is in the universe. One thing I can actually explain, I hope, is this one. So this lecture already gives you a calculation of what happens if I change the spectral index. So of course, one thing I'll be doing is, in this case, I show that ns equals 1 propagates into L times L plus 1 times CL flat. If actually the primordial spectrum is tilted, the whole thing tilts. And the calculation is more complicated. I get gamma functions and things like that. But it's not difficult to predict that if I have more power primordially on small scales, then the whole spectrum is going to go up. And finally, although I computed the integrated Sachs-Wolfe, we had to sweat a bit for it, but I did tell you the integrated Sachs-Wolfe is going to contain the gravitational waves. They're important. The gravitational waves will be contributing also to the low Ls. Let me see, I think it's this one. In this case, actually, the component is there. The gravitational wave component is there. And what you see is that you're basically pushing up all the plateau because you have not only the scalar contribution, which I computed today, there's going to be an extra contribution coming from here. So I think I'll stop here. Any questions? If not, I'll go for lunch.
Did you have a look at the question?